Someone once asked the Dalai Lama how he fit his sitting into the days when he had a full schedule. He responded that he added an hour to his sitting. This morning, when I was making my breakfast with a head full of revisions that I needed to make to my talk, I decided to wash last night's dishes at that moment. We'll soon see what this did for my talk. I'd like to begin by thanking Junru for giving me this opportunity to speak to the Sangha today. My topic today is observing and violating the precepts, which seem to serve in Buddhist ethics as a communal guide for our behavior, much like the Ten Commandments serve in the Judeo-Christian and Islamic traditions. Since Zen replaces the conventional independent abiding self with the impermanent co-arising provisional self, the role of a behavioral guide in the context of impermanence will be more complex than the simple rule book of conventional ethics. We must come to see the precepts as dynamic, as becoming something new with every moment, or their perceived stagnation may even cause a bodhisattva to contemplate violating them out of compassion for our students, for their students. But we have some ground to cover before trying to make sense of such examples of this, as in Nansen and his cap. I think some brief philosophical background will help orient this discussion. The word philosophical tends to bring a glaze to people's eyes, but the pain will last for only a few minutes. I take philosophy here to mean how we think about our thinking, how we decide what is real, how we decide whether we know something or not, and how we determine how we should behave. These are all separate areas of study and have separate names. Metaphysics is the study of reality, epistemology is the study of knowing, and ethics is the study of good behavior. In our Mondo discussions and koan study, we often bump into these questions without identifying them by these sometimes cumbersome terms that have come down to us from the Greeks. This Greek organization of our thoughts on thinking has permeated our culture for 2,500 years, and we are accustomed to separate our lives into these three distinct areas: how I know what is real, how I know what to believe, and how I should behave. If we can discover that existence has some specific foundation, such as the Judeo-Christian Islamic God, then the answers to these questions are given by our relation to this divine foundation. Then what causes delusion, misunderstanding, and mistakes is our becoming separated from God. The Inferno section of the Divine Comedy is where Dante describes the conditions and inhabitants of hell, showing us what it's like to live in separation from God. We find there many who thought their physical body was more real than their supposedly divine soul, also fortune tellers who claim to know what cannot be known, and many levels of people who mistook. The Greek word for sin takes its root from making a mistake, who mistook destructive behavior for what would bring them greater fulfillment. This all sounds quite familiar. Buddhism does not have such a foundation, however. We are still faced with these three areas of thinking about thinking, but we do not have any divine point of illumination from outside that can enlighten each of these areas for us and permit us to live our lives with purpose and certainty. We are trained by our language, history, and our innate tendency to see patterns in our experience to seek for such a foundation. Somehow we have all arrived at this point in our lives where we are here in the Sangha, exploring the possibility that there is no foundation except for ourselves. Many experiences have brought us together. There is our biology of sickness, old age, and death, to which we could add our experiences of poverty, war, and discrimination, to convince us that all attempts to find such a foundation in the world have not yet succeeded. We need to find a way to live in this world beyond such an external foundation. And this answer can only come from each of us. I need to experience it for myself as the Buddha experienced it for himself. The way Buddhism describes for the path to this experience is often described to be a non-path, some sort of third way that is neither of the this or that dualistic choices we are used to, but instead enters a realm of experience in which the dualism is cut into one. For instance, the dualism of thinking or not thinking dissolves into non-thinking, where thinking becomes a kind of consciousness or awareness that no longer has the qualities of personal discrimination and judgment. Our provisional self, which navigates our daily experiences, still judges differences and does make choices about which act to take, but does not move through a world of substantial and enduring beings, but rather one of conditions and consequences which are ever-changing, that is, a world of impermanence. This Buddhist path is going to have the same dimensions which we have seen are shared by all human experience, reality, knowledge, and behavior. But now these are going to move beyond our usual dualistic thinking and turn to the reality of interdependent co-arising, the knowledge of not knowing, and the ethics of no self. My concern today is with this third area of ethical behavior, which brings me and my provisional self to my project for Spring Ango, which is to pay attention to practicing the precepts in my daily life while also maintaining an awareness of the impermanence of all things, including the precepts. I plan to focus on the three pure precepts and the 10 grave precepts, taking one each week as I try to follow the precepts while taking into account that they are as impermanent as everything else. Week one concerned not doing evil, and I worked on not leaving a mess. We can train ourselves to make our life spaces more livable for everyone, but not everyone shares the same definition of what actually constitutes a mess. In week two, I found donating blood or other human parts such as stem cells seems close to a perfect good, but this is only available for those who are able to make such donations. The goods we enact and the bads we avoid can be appropriate in some moments, but do not always transfer to other moments. How can we deal with this impermanence? When studying for Jukai, the role of the precept seems to be simple. Fitting it into the foundations and patterns our minds always seek and merging with examples in our culture, such as the biblical Ten Commandments. But we soon hit a speed bump, causing us to slow down. The Ten Commandments are all addressed to a self, capital S. Thou shalt not do this or that. This thou is an enduring self, which will continue into the future to be blessed or cursed for its adherence or disrespect for the commandments. Buddhism does not have an ongoing self like this, which can be eternally rewarded or punished. Buddhist ethics here seems to be headed in a different direction than we are used to. When I taught college ethics, the common approach to the course was to examine the variety of ethical systems that have been proposed throughout time and space, created to help us have certainty that we are behaving in the best way possible. Some of these find a source that determines the duties that we should perform, either in the word of God, such as the Ten Commandments, or in some interpretation of human nature, while another main group of thinkers looks at the consequences of our actions as the source of their value, such as when utilitarianism tries to measure the utility of every act and then determines our choice by computing the greatest number of utility, choosing whatever brings what is most useful to the most people. Buddhism does away with both of these reasoning systems, as the consequences spreading throughout Indra's net are too vast for our understanding them, and the belief that there are duties related to a stable and continuous human nature is denied by our realization of interdependent co-arising and impermanence. If ethics does not give us a stable system for choosing right behavior, thus providing for the certainty that we are acting in the best possible way, then what is it good for? Buddhist ethics, like Zazen, is a practice. It does not exist as a separate set of instructions, but rather like bumpers on a bowling alley. They help keep the ball stay in play instead of totally sinking into the gutter of delusion and despair. Also like Zazen, the precepts are a practice that deepens and takes on new meaning over time. In Buddhism, the three dimensions of philosophy that we have been discussing mutually reinforce each other to provide ever-deepening experiences in each of the areas as they interact. As we better understand our own nature, as well as the nature of the time and space we experience, we are able to better appreciate the provisional self that is making the ethical choices called for in this moment, and not needing the every time, everywhere systems of traditional philosophy. Since ethics requires us to distinguish the qualities of this moment to determine how I should behave in it, it raises our level of awareness as we expand our consciousness to appreciate everything in this moment. The complexity of this moment shows me both the limits of my knowing and the delusions I believed in order to simplify an attempt to have control of this complexity. The precepts are not only for the sake of correct behavior and the dualisms that right and wrong might entail, but ultimately they help move us beyond our common sense of being an independent agent among other similarly and separated independent objects, and pull us instead into the world of this moment, the world of co-origination and Indrasna, of not knowing, and of the impermanence of the provisional self. Being Upright is Reb Anderson's book on the Bodhisattva precepts that is used by many Jukai classes, including at our Zendo. He writes that he originally wanted to write a different book, which was his translation of an 18th century book called The Essence of Zen Precepts by Banjin Dotan. But he was persuaded that it would be too easily misunderstood and perhaps even dangerous. Anderson explains that this book, quote, presents the Bodhisattva precepts primarily from the perspective of their ultimate or liberating meaning, which is beyond doing or not doing, and is less concerned with their conventional or literary meaning, that is, what to do or not to do. He continues that the book's author, Banjin Dotan, again, quote, warns explicitly that the text should not be sold in bookstores, should not be left lying about where an uninitiated person could read it, and should not be given to those who have not been given precept transmission. To receive the ultimate meaning of the precepts without being grounded in the conventional meaning is inappropriate and potentially harmful, end quote. Several years ago, I was touring a Tibetan monastery in Madison, Wisconsin, and we entered into the room where the scrolls were kept and a class was taking place. The monk immediately stopped teaching when we entered, and explained as we left that because we were not properly prepared, if we were to hear his teaching, it could be very dangerous for us. My reaction was that I wanted to hear this mysterious lesson, that just hearing some words was not going to harm me, that as an educated person, I was prepared for whatever a teacher or a book might throw at me. My conventional self was in full display in this situation. The capital self that Anderson is talking about. I wanted to add another book to my bookshelf or idea to my collection for use in my research or classroom. My accumulating mind imagined ideas are like numbers, each with their own integrity and borders, and not realize that some are provocateurs, setting up experiments in our minds, which as we engage with them can create contradiction and paradox. The mental equivalent of street demonstrations and no confidence votes. The rise of the non-self is one possible outcome of all this, while nihilism could be another. Anderson discusses this potential evolution or revolution of the non-self through the practice of the precepts in the sixth chapter of his book. Most of us taking the Jukai vow to observe the precepts are beginning our practice and operate using the conventional dualistic truths of our culture. And so we see the precepts as a guide to doing right and avoiding wrong. Anderson says, quote, only by practicing wholeheartedly according to the literal meaning of the precepts can we fully experience the limitations and frustrations of this conventional approach, end quote. The precepts provide a necessary support while they also help us to begin to experience the world in ways that contradict these conventional dualistic truths. Good actions do not always have good consequences, nor do good intentions have good consequences. In fact, the consequences are found to be much more complicated than any simple cause and effect. We find that, in fact, causes and effects seem to expand infinitely beyond our knowing in all directions. It is easy to fall into nihilism at this point when the conventional self is still strong, but the guidance of our conventional bumpers has been discredited. This is a very common danger, as many of our actions in adolescence readily illustrate. This is where we come to appreciate the role of the three treasures in the precepts and our vow to take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha as our conventional world is challenged. Our independent self struggles to make sense of our dualistic world picture. As our independent self struggles, we experience the relevance of teachings of such images as Indra's net, where the causal links to any one effect are beyond counting, displaying the not knowing of any one position within the net about all the other positions, which extend beyond the horizon in every direction. The image of my independent self as the individual center of ethical action is revealed to be merely a conventional story. My behavior as a cause is tied in with all these other strands in the net. The strings I pull are only a few among thousands. I share with them unknown and unknowable others. I share them with unknown and unknowable others. My ability to know the consequences of my good or bad actions is fully compromised, as well as my independent agency. I am now a part of an interdependent co-arising. Take a drink. Since now nothing has an independent fixed existence, the precepts themselves are also not fixed things. At first, they seem to provide a place where we can securely stand, where we can abide. But the good and bad prove to be relative and slippery. For example, the Catholic Church for centuries was sure God supported capital punishment, until in 1994, they suddenly understood that this was wrong and changed their teaching. Likewise, war, another form of killing, is bad unless it is somehow determined to be just and then it is good. But for example, in World War II, this seemed to be a toss-up for the church for many years. The capacity to succeed in constructing a firm abode is shown to be very limited. Even the substance of the right and wrong that I hope I will be able to use again tomorrow turns out to expire as soon as it is used. There is no permanence here. Our skillful means, our upaya, which we so carefully cultivate, is good only for this moment. The upaya of one moment can be a cause of suffering in the next. We have seen how precepts encourage us in developing a more dynamic sense of the interdependent relations in the world, and also to the precepts themselves. If we merely paste the precepts over our previously conventional ethics, then a bodhisattva, one who is acting out of compassion for all sentient beings, may find that the moment includes people so deeply suffering from their conventional understandings of the precepts that violating these precepts themselves might be a way to awaken them from their conventional sleepwalking. That is, the bodhisattva violating these precepts. This more activist meaning of Anderson's liberating power of the precepts is what the Bojan Dautan essay that he was translating described. Wan Hyo, who is called the Dogen of Korean Zen, was a 7th-century Korean monk who wrote his own essay on the same point called Essentials on Observing and Violating the Fundamentals of the Bodhisattva Precepts, which has been translated by Jin Park. She is a very accessible Korean Zen adept and writer whose many essays have helped me understand both Zen and ethics. And I'd be happy to give you references if you want to look up any of her pieces. One hill, similar to Benchen Dotan, describes the limitations of the precepts in their conventional appearance to us as stable objects providing a stable abode where we can establish a stable, independent ethical self. Both works come to the paradoxical conclusion that as we become more realized, that is, moving away from this conventional idea, the way to follow the precepts may actually be to violate these conventional understandings of them. Our appropriation of the precepts as dualistic, for example, defining good versus bad or evil, and secure in their enduring guidance for an independent self, must somehow be shaken and uprooted. One Hyo confronted this by becoming what was known as a mad monk. And there are a number of mad monk biographies in the Korean history. Park develops also in the Japanese Zen history as well. Park develops this image further in her essay called The Transgression and the Ethics of Tension. She shows how the transgressions of these bodhisattvas were taken as examples of their compassion. An ancient biography entitled One Hyo the Unbridled describes his many years as an abbot, followed by his decision to depart from the monastic life, then his engaging in sexual activity with a princess that produced a son, who also became a monk later, and his subsequent wandering as an impoverished lay teacher, quote, singing and dancing and proselytizing with his songs, end quote. This might sound quite romantic, this singing and dancing, but he was not some entertaining troubadour. Here's an example of one of his lyrics, quote, how many lives have you failed to practice by passing your days and nights in vain? How much longer will this empty body survive for you not to practice in your lifetime? This body will inevitably come to an end, and who knows what body you will have next time. Isn't this an urgent matter? Isn't this an urgent matter? End quote. The music that accompanies this has been lost, but you can determine one on your own. His apparent violation of the precepts, engaging in sex, working with lay people, giving up his robe, was out of compassion to better engage his audience, even at the personal cost of his violations. He took upon himself as a bodhisattva the responsibility for the consequences of his actions and the karma that it might create. Part suggests that in Wan Hyo's world, like ours, people were so entrenched in their conventional reality, quote, that it was not something to be completely overcome by blindly observing bodhisattva precepts. Rather, transgression of the precepts here becomes inevitable, end quote. She thinks the presence of precept violation in the mad monk stories shows that the effort to take our practice into our daily life, to inform the relative and provisional with the absolute, creates an enduring tension, which is, quote, not something that is moving forward toward any resolution, but as a reality of existence as it is, end quote. To be aware and respect the karmic opportunities of the moment and the available upaya resources without falling into making them something abiding of the one, make something abiding of either one, is our common and ongoing experience of this tension in our lives. Now we are finally ready for Nansen and his killing of the cat, which happens when the monks quarrel over ownership and possession of this cat. And Nansen picks it up and says, if any one of you can speak, then I will not kill it. But no one responded. No one seemed able to defend their possession of the cat or to let it go. The greed of each side in the monks' quarrel, was such that they would rather have the cat die than lose possession of it. They have already disrespected the cat's life. And so Nansen cut the cat in two, an apparent violation of the precepts. This story appears as a koan in The Gateless Gate, The Blue Cliff Record, and The Book of Equanimity, a rare triple appearance, For years, I've had difficulty warming up to this aspect of Nansen, but my work on this talk has helped me to better understand his situation. Dogen comments on this koan in his Zui Monkey number 6, suggesting that Nansen could have said, quote, "You know how to cut the cat in two with one sword, but you don't know how to cut it into one," end quote. Since the assembly could not answer, had nothing to say, Dogen would then have released the already cut cat. But Nansen does not say or do this and proceeds with his cutting, taking upon himself the responsibility and the karma for his tragic and compassionate act. When Joshua later puts his sandal on his head, Nansen saying that this would have saved the cat seems to be not about Joshua's particular gesture, but rather that his presence and his making this or another gesture would have changed the moment. The situation would have been different with Joshua there. There's nothing enduring about the cat or the sandals. Each is part of a particular moment. And Nansen thought it necessary in his moment to take on a responsibility that Dogen, from his view many years later, thought he would not. Unless we are in that moment and have evolved in the impermanence of our provisional self, it is very difficult to say what we would do. Since we're at the beginning of Easter week, we could also look at the example of Jesus as a bodhisattva, taking on the responsibility of a killing to occur, in this case his own, out of compassion for his followers. Most of us are still struggling with the tensions provided by the precepts when our provisional self tries to bring the insights of our awareness to the insights of our awareness of the absolute into the choices demanded by our daily lives. The precepts do provide general guidance in our daily activities, but perhaps more important, they also provide opportunities for moving the center of these activities from the convention of an independent self into realization of our refuge in the three treasures of the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. The tension created by our awareness of not knowing, interdependent co-arising, and impermanence as we go about our affairs in a world seeking information, selfhood, and stability is frequently overwhelming, but also can be creative. The precepts keep us engaged, giving us the experience of cutting the two realms into one, and then doing it again. Thank you for your attention, and may your lives go well.